Now I would like to introduce our main speaker this evening,
Marie B. from San Diego.
Good evening. My name is Marie and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Marie.
You know, the big book says that we describe what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like today. And I'm going to try to stay in a timeline, and that's really not for your benefit. It's because I've gotten old. And if I don't do that, the train goes off the track and, you know, we could end up anywhere. You know, hindsight is always 20/20, so I can tell you today that I was born across the invisible line of alcoholism, but I didn't know it. You know, and I was raised in a nice Catholic family where everybody was just social drinkers. And I don't know how that happened, but, you know, I still am a real alcoholic. I'm the firstborn of five girls, so, you know, my hat's off to my father. And I want you to know that I was 6 years old before I knew for a fact that I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief. You know, and that's a terrible thing to have to admit, but, you know, but by six, if you had something that I wanted, I would take it. And the really worst part is I didn't even know that was, like, wrong, and I was old enough to have known that, you know. And I was a terrible liar. I'm really grateful that I did not end up with children like the child I was, you know. They wish that on people. I've always been very grateful to God that that did not happen to me. I also, at those early years, the ism was in full swing, you know. I thought that I was, like, different. You know, I had been, like, adopted or landed from a different planet, all that crazy stuff we think. And the really strange part about that is I'm the firstborn of those five girls, and we all look like we came out of the little same carbon mold. So it wasn't like I couldn't look at everybody in my family, and they looked just like me, but I still thought that I didn't belong there. So fast forward now, I'm, like, 16 years old. Now, I don't know how you were at 16. I, at 16, thought I was a full-grown, mature adult. I want you to know that today at 60 plus, that's my age from now until I die, by the way, 60 plus, I don't think I'm a full-grown mature adult, but I certainly believe that at 16, you know. And by the time I graduated from high school, I also knew that my parents were the stupidest people in the world. I luckily remembered that when my children were that age. And, you know, it brought me around to my first geographic. Now, I want to share this with you. I still haven't picked up a drink, but without ever having alcohol in my system, my solutions were worse than my problems. So my solution for, you know, parental authority and how to get out from underneath that was to enlist in the United States Navy. Now, you don't have to have been in the military to know that if your problem is authority, the military is probably not the best place to go. But I did, you know. I also have this other defect of character. It's I'll show you, you S-O-B. Those are only letters, three of them. It's the four-letter rule. I heard that up front. You know, so, you know, if you tell me I can't do something, I am bound to prove you wrong. So as my father was a 20-year Navy man. My father also was very old school. He believed that women belonged at home, barefoot and pregnant. You know, he was not thrilled with the idea that I was going in the military. But as he put me on the bus that 4th of July, he said to me, you know, it really doesn't make any difference. You're such a slob, you'll never make it through boot camp. And I, you know, I'm really grateful for that because it was true. And if he hadn't said that to me, I probably wouldn't have made it through boot camp. But, you know, I had to prove my father wrong. You know, now, some of you, I'm sure, have been in the military. So when you go into the military, they give you a bunch of tests, and they decide what it is that you should be able to do with your life. Now, I want you to know I wrote really high in things I knew nothing about, like mechanical aptitude. Now, I didn't know a ball-peen hammer from a Phillips head screwdriver, but I still wrote high in mechanical aptitude and logic and math. And, you know, that landed me a place that I always wanted to be. It landed me in a training class with 2,000 guys. Now, I want you to know, you want to talk about die and go to heaven, right? So I went through this. I got selected to be a flight simulator instructor, and I went through all of this training. It was really long, and I was, like I said, the only girl there. And when I got out, I got stationed at a military base. The only thing was they hadn't had female flight simulator instructors since World War II, so they didn't really realize I was going to be a girl when I showed up there. And I'll never forget. It was like yesterday. I walked into this link shack, and this chief petty officer, his name was Stan Gross. Now, I can tell you, I dated men for years. I couldn't tell you their name, but I remember this chief. He took one look at me, and he said, "You are a girl." That's what he said. And I said to him, "Brilliant deduction, Chief," is what I said. Now, I'm an E2, so if you've been in the military, you know that wasn't really a smart move. But, so they tried a lot of things that week to get rid of me. And when that didn't work, they took me on Friday to the EM Club, and they introduced me to my friend Budweiser. Now, I don't blame the Navy for my alcoholism, because I tell you that somewhere in my life, it would have crossed paths with my friend Budweiser, and I was off and running. And I was instantaneously a drunk. From the first day I drank until the very last day I drank, I always drank the same way. And that was that I drank all that I could, whenever I could, and I never, ever knew when to stop. But I wasn't a blackout drinker. And in the military, you don't have, like, a lot of choices. In the morning, you get up. You either get up and go to work, or you get up and go to sick call, but you get up. So I always did that. My drinking only caused me a few little problems in the military. One of them was a court martial. Just a little problem. And I want you to tell me, when I got to the AA, they have that questions, 20 questions, and one of the questions they said, "Have you ever been to jail?" And I checked no, because I want you to know, after my court martial, where I was sentenced to 30 days in jail, they didn't want to bother the expense of shipping me to another state for a women's brig, so they just restricted me to the barracks, so I didn't let that count. And I want you to know, I only went out drinking a few times during that restriction. I actually left base once. Anyway, just to give you an idea, I really wasn't quite into authority. But unfortunately, my alcoholism really was to be the end of my military career, because what happened to me probably happens to a lot of women, especially, way back when I was young. And that's that, drinking and men and all that kind of stuff, I ended up pregnant. And at that time, they wouldn't let you stay in the military if you were pregnant. So, I was out the door with a medical discharge. I have to give Navy credit for that. They did give me hospitalization and allow me to birth that child. But it was 1966, and I have good Catholic parents. And, the word from my parents is, do not come back into the state of Florida if you still have that child. So I gave birth to her, and I put her up for adoption, and I turned my back on that part of my life, and I just went on with my drinking. But, it's really hard to live and drink, when you have minimal employment. So one more big geographic, I moved back in with Mommy and Daddy. Now, I do this because I can't get a job that pays enough money to allow me to drink in the manner that I had been accustomed to in the military. Because booze is really cheap in the military. And if you're a girl and you got 20,000 guys hanging around, you don't really have to buy a lot of rounds. So now I'm at home. My mother still has these four other little kids, and I'm going to work. I have a job. I'm going to work, and I'm drinking, and I'm going to work, and I'm drinking. I'm staying out every morning till 2 o'clock and coming home. And I always get up and go to work, even if I have the 6 a.m. shift. So I'm sure there's nothing wrong with the way I'm drinking. Fast forward about a year after living home with Mom and Dad, my father has this little freak accident, puts him in the hospital, puts him in traction. Now, my mother is trying to work full-time, take care of these four kids, and deal with my father in the hospital. And am I helping out? No. I'm at the bar drinking till 2 o'clock every morning. And I came home one morning at 2 o'clock, and the thing that really upset my mother always the worst about my drinking wasn't the fact that I was drinking. It was the fact that I operated a motor vehicle under the influence of alcohol, even if I was only driving 5 or 6 blocks. And, I walked in the house that night. I was 25, 26 years old, 2 a.m. in the morning, a little drunk, and I had a confrontation with my mother. She knocked me across the living room. My mother stood about like 5'1 and weighed, anyway. She had never hit me my entire life, but she knocked me across the living room that night. And, you know, I had that good alcoholic solution. I packed up everything I owned into a 1967 Ford Mustang and moved from Miami, Florida to Los Angeles, California. Because I knew that everything would be different here. And I want you to know a lot of things were different here, but not me. But I only know that in retrospect, you know, because I thought everything was going to be really wonderful when I got to, I moved to Hollywood. That's where young girls move. And, you know, but I got a job back with the phone company because I'd been working with the phone company at the time as in one of those female jobs because it was still back when, I mean, I had gone to them, to the airlines when I got out of the military with my, you know, 30,000 logged in certified hours. They just laughed at me because I was a girl and offered me a job as a typist, but, you know, I couldn't type. And so I'm working for the phone company. I come out here to California. I'm working in the business office of the phone company. And, you know, the hole in my gut's getting bigger and bigger. And the drinking's, you know, I'm making sure that if I have nothing else, I have alcohol. But I still can't see that there's anything wrong with the way I drink because I get up every morning and go to work. And I have a car, and I have a place to live, and I have a bank account. You know, and those are things that can keep us really in denial. And but, you know, I knew that something really wasn't quite right, so I went out looking for a solution. Mm-hmm. You know, and I figured the problem was that I wasn't married. And what I needed to find was him, yeah. I found him, all right. Now, I want you to know I'm really grateful to God that I did not find another alcoholic. I found this man who apparently likes... He really belongs in Al-Anon, but he doesn't believe. Anyway, but who likes to take care of women who can't take care of themselves, really. And at least that's what I think in hindsight. And he was a drinker, all right. He maybe drank 2 beers a year. I never quite understood that, but that was the way he drank. I drank the way I drank. And we played the on-and-off dating game for 6 years. And finally, we got married. I thought that would solve all of my problems, you know. In that time, some interesting things happened. The phone company started opening up traditional male jobs to females. And I applied, and I went in, and I worked inside doing all those little wire runs and stuff. And I'd been there about 6 months, and they came to me one day, and they said, you know, the government really wants us to have some women outside as installers. Would you be interested in doing that? And I said, of course, I can do that. Now, I'm working with 18-year-old guys. I'm 30, and they think this is the craziest thing they ever heard of. Some 30-year-old old lady is going to go climb phone poles. So, I don't know about you, but for me, if it was really, really important that I stayed sober, it was really, really impossible. You know, so the night before I went to pole climbing school, actually the weekend before I went to pole climbing school, to be really honest, I had a really nice little binge, and I woke up on that Monday morning of pole climbing school with a really nice hangover. And, you know, I fixed that hangover. I had half a bottle of mouthwash, a couple of cans of beer, took a shower, got in my car, and went to pole climbing school. It was to be 108 degrees that day, so they give you salt tablets. And I want you to know I made it through pole climbing school, and I climbed those poles up and down, all day with those guys. The only difference was that often when I hit the ground, I also had to go into the bathroom and throw up. And I want you to know I blamed it on the salt tablets. You know, all my life I knew there was nothing wrong with the way I drink. So, you know, you would think that Mr. I'm going to date you on and off for 6 years and finally marry you would have some clue what was going on. And he did have a small clue. Because on our wedding planning, he said to me, I want you to promise me you only have one drink at the reception. And I said, of course, dear. So, and I kept that promise, but what happened was my friends brought me this really big glass. So I still have it today. I put change in it. So I want you to know that, you know, there's a solution for everything. So I marry Mr. right now, and... You know, and I get on with my life. Now, what happened was things didn't get better because my new husband really did not like some of my habits. And one of the ones he hated the most was that I used to go drinking with those other installers after work. And I was one of those people who said, honey, I'll be home by 8, and got home when the bars closed because I'm a real alcoholic, and that's the only way I know how to drink, you know. So he pretty soon, you know, would not stand for my bar drinking, and so I became a stay-at-home, well, not stay-at-home because I still went to work, but I became a closet drinker, you know, and I hid it all over the house, and, you know, I'd put it in my coffee in the morning, and, you know, sometimes I'd have a few beers at lunch, so, you know, most of you probably didn't live in Beverly Hills back in the 70s, but if you did and I wired your house up, I'm really sorry. So, but the hole in my gut is still getting bigger, and I'm going out looking for another one of my brilliant solutions. Now, my solution was I really needed children. But I really thought deep in my heart, I really believed that since I had already had a child and given her away, that God wouldn't let me have any more children. But, you know, I don't have that kind of a God. And so I got pregnant with Elizabeth, and I'm still a telephone installer, but I go to the doctor, and I say to the doctor, is it all right if I drink while I'm pregnant? Now, this is the 70s, guys, so, you know, things were different then. And he said to me, well, honey, how much do you drink? And I told him the great alcoholic truth, just a little wine with dinner. And he said to me, there's nothing wrong with a little wine with dinner. I mean, that poor doctor had no way of knowing that my idea of a little wine with dinner was a 2-gallon jug of Gallovin Rosé, or half gallon, or whatever size they came in. He didn't know that was my idea of a little wine with dinner. But anyway, so now I'm pregnant, I'm an installer. I also have this other defect of character. I love to do things for shock value. And so I'm still an installer, and I'm getting pregnant, and I'm getting more pregnant, and I'm still an installer. I want you to know, by the time you're about 7 months pregnant, and you're wearing your tools on your shoulder, and you're showing up at little old ladies' houses in Beverly Hills, it's really quite shocking. But, you know, one more time, you know, I was bound and determined that I wasn't going to let anything get in my way. And, you know, I continued installing telephone service, not climbing poles or crawling under houses, but I continued doing work up until just before my pregnancy. And, you know, God was really good to me. I actually was sober the day I delivered my child. Yeah, I'm grateful for that. And, you know, and my child was born without any, like, real effects from my alcohol or from my smoking, which I didn't know I should even think about quitting. And so now I have this little baby, and I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I'm drinking more than ever. Because I don't have any I get up in the morning, I fix the husband breakfast, I pack his lunch, I send him off to work, and that leaves me and a baby all day. So then I found out a really another great truth if you're a woman and you're an alcoholic of my variety, and that's that alcoholism and birth control don't really work real well together. So when baby A is 5 months old, I am pregnant with baby B. Now, poor baby B, she lives here in San Diego now, by the way, poor baby B, she really doesn't have a chance because I don't even have to go to work to interrupt my drinking. I'm drinking around the clock with baby B. But, you know, again, God was really good to me. My second daughter was born without any kind of defects from my drinking, at least not physically. And so now I have two little babies. I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I'm drinking around the clock, and I'm trying to run only with other stay-at-home moms that drink like I do. And there are not a lot of them, luckily. So now I'm trying to find excuses to drink outside of the house because I'm getting a little bored with not having a social life. You know, I managed somehow to become, shortly before I got sober, the commander of an all-male American Legion post. You know, that gave me a monthly excuse to be out of the house and go and drink. You know, it was really fun. I still had that commitment when I got sober. But anyway, we're going to fast forward. The babies are now 1 and 2. It's December of 1979, and I'm really, really getting tired of just drinking at home. And so I come up with this brilliant idea. What I do is during the daytime, these children are young, right? I put them in the car, and I go to the mall, and I do my Christmas shopping. Then I come home, and I leave all the stuff in the car. I take the kids inside. I fix dinner. The minute the husband hits the front door, it's, dinner's on the table, hon. I gotta go Christmas shopping. I'm out. I'm in the bar. Toys R Us doesn't close till midnight. I'm in the bar till midnight. Come home, unload all the stuff. I want you to know that in December of 1979, those two little girls had so much Christmas stuff that it filled the entire living room of our home, and my husband left all the big stuff in the garage. But during that month also of December 1979, my husband came to me one day, and what he said was, you know what, Marie? If you want to drink yourself to death, that's your business. But the girls and I don't want to watch. And, you know, I had one of those great alcoholic paradox mind moments. Half of my brain said, any judge in this land will give this man custody of these children and this house. And the other half of my brain said, you know, the problem in this relationship is the man does not know how to drink. And if he would just learn to drink like a normal person, you know, because part of the insanity of alcoholism was I had blinders as big as any racehorse. You know, I could not tell there was anything wrong with the way I drank, and no matter how many insane things I did. But, you know, but that got me to thinking, and I had actually done a little talking. I had managed in that same time frame to actually tell a doctor how much I really drank, and he put me in touch with a counselor at a care unit. But, you know, I talked to her and decided that, you know, I really wasn't like you all. I didn't have, like, you know, any really big alcoholic problem after all. I mean, I showed up to a meeting with her absolutely stone sober, you know, because I could actually stop drinking for, you know, 30 or 40 hours sometimes. So that was Christmas. We had this Christmas. We had all this stuff. You know, it's getting to be into January, you know, and my drinking is really all of a sudden progressing. And, I end up, my husband's out of town. I end up on a weekend bender. And for whatever reason, on a Monday morning, January 21st, 1980, you know, I just said, you know what? I just need to go to this care unit. I need to get my act together. Now, I want you to know I didn't go to that care unit to get sober one day at a time. I didn't go there to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't go there so I could be your speaker here almost 32 years later. I just went there to get the old man off my back and to get my act together, because I figured then when I divorce this guy, I'll get the house, I'll get the kids, and then I can get on with my drinking. And I want you to know those were my plans for me the day I walked into that hospital. I am really grateful that those were not God's plans for me that day I walked in that hospital. You know, God had a whole different set of plans for me, luckily. So I check into this care unit. Now, this is a 21-day program, and I know everything. I want you to know, because when I got here, I knew everything, kind of like when I was 16. I was an obnoxious patient. It just is really a wonder when I look back with my 2020 vision that they even let me stay 21 days, let alone the fact that they came to me on day 19 and said, you know what, Marie? Some are sicker than others, and we think you should stay an extra week. I was devastated. I thought I could run the hospital, and they're trying to tell me that some are sicker than others. So I made them this bargain. No one ever explained to me why they accepted this bargain. This was my barter with this care unit. I said, okay, but you know, if I have to stay another week, I'm going to be in here for Valentine's Day, and I'm not going to be able to spend it with Mr. Right Now. And what am I going to, you know, oh, poor me, we have to have a party. Now, for some reason, they said yes. If you stay an extra week, we'll have a party on Valentine's Day. You know, it was a pretty funny party. I want you to know we had cupcakes and that awful red yicky punch you make for your kids. But we had music, and I learned something really important that first December 14th. I learned that I could drink without having, I mean drink. I learned that I could dance. I learned that I couldn't drink. I learned that I could dance without having alcohol in my system. And I want you to know, up until that moment, I didn't know I could do anything without alcohol in my system. You know, I used to think that alcohol was the thing that set me free. You know, and today I know that alcohol was nothing but a ball and chain. But, you know, I certainly didn't know it while I was out there doing all those really fun things. So we have the party. The party's over. We're here. We got 28 days in now. And I overhear the counselors sharing with each other the night before I'm due to be discharged. And what they're saying is, you know, I really don't think we should let her out. And the other guy, and the male Al-Anon counselor guy says, yeah, I don't give her 24 hours on the street. You know, I'm just one of those other things, like my father, and you'll never make it through boot camp. I'm really grateful that he said those words and that I overheard him. Because I went to, you know, I walked up to him, and I poked him in his little chest, and I said, I will show you, you three letters, S-O-B. I can stay sober just like everybody else. That's what I told them. Now, the reason they didn't want me out was because I had not quite figured out that really important thing that people need to figure out when they get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had not figured out that I was an alcoholic. You know, maybe I had a little drinking problem. I was one of those who came here with just a little drinking problem, you know, but I was not alcoholic. And, you know, but they let me out, and I started my road to recovery. And I'd like to tell you that I just got a sponsor right away and jumped into the steps and did all those good things you're supposed to do, but I've been told to tell the truth here. So, but what I did do that I really attribute my sobriety was I dove nose first into service work. When I was in that hospital, people used to come to the hospital, ex-patients, and they would pick us up and they would drive us to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. So the first bit of service I ever did in AA was to go back to that care unit and drive people to meetings. And I don't know why God did this to me, but I used to get some of the most obnoxious people to drive to meetings. But I still suited up and showed up. That hospital had an alumni. And I thought, oh, how exciting. We can have a big picnic at 6 months, and we're all, you know, get back together. And, you know, and then I found out that the alumni was kind of defunct. So I became very active in getting that organized because I did a lot of social stuff in my early sobriety. But the one thing I did do that was really right was I didn't put alcohol in my mouth no matter what. Some of the things I did that were really wrong that I don't recommend, but it was my story, is that, you know, they say Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of attraction. And I found some really attractive things when I came to alcohol. I all wore tight little jeans, you know, and I want you to know that I hung on the guys in Alcoholics Anonymous my first year of sobriety. And I want you to know that God was really, really good to me. None of them hung back, you know, or you might really have a different speaker tonight. You know, so I slowly got into service work, but I was really, like I said, not exactly a model recovery person. When I was sober 3 months, I was elected co-secretary of a small meeting in Woodland Hills, California. And that week, the secretary person called me and said, I'm never going back to that meeting again. It is all yours. At 3 months of sobriety, I took that really literally. And I became the secretary and the treasurer and the cake lady and the coffee maker and the setup person. But, you know, that really wasn't what made me dictator of that meeting. What made me dictator of that meeting was I didn't hold elections after that. I was so bad, some of the people in the hospital used to think I was a social worker. Anyhow, you know, and I know that a lot of that had to do with the fact that if I'm really busy working on you, I don't have to work on me at all, you know. But, so, I take my one-year cake. I love this. Here's what happens to people who don't really work the steps or have a sponsor or do anything. By the time you have a year of sobriety and you really didn't drink for the whole year, you still have a really, really big ego. And since I was the secretary and the treasurer and everybody else, including the cake lady, for my first AA birthday, I want you to know, I went and bought a really big cake. I had pretty yellow roses put all over it, and I had my name inscribed on it. Let me tell you, that's not what we did for most people, you know. And I know today I did that because it was really important to me that you knew I was really important, you know, because I didn't know that I was anything still, you know. And in that first year of sobriety, at about 9 months, my husband came to me, and he said, you're going to need to make a choice. He said, it's either me or Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I told him that he was asking me to compare apples to oranges. I had figured that much out, and that I wasn't giving up AA. And it was, I stayed married to him for another 5 or 6 years. Anyway, at about 14 months of sobriety, the person who was to become my first sponsor came up to me, and what he said was, you know, Marie, leadership in Alcoholics Anonymous is rotational, and I suggest we have elections. And I want you to know that meeting has elections now every 6 months. And for the 29 years that I was in Los Angeles, I was at those elections every 6 months because I figured it was the only way to make restitution for my wonderful dictatorship. Trying to stay in order. What was the next thing? I guess so the next thing part of service I became involved in was the Hospital and Institutional Committee of the San Fernando Valley. When I got sober, there was no Hospital and Institutional Committee of the San Fernando Valley. People came in all the way from downtown L.A. out to Woodland Hills to carry the message. You know, they came and they were dressed nice and they had showered and they smelled good and they were had bright sparkly eyes and big smiley faces. And when they opened their mouth, I just wanted to go to the other room and throw up. You know, and so I tell people when I did panels, you know, if that's the way you feel about us, you are in the right place. You know, but so they started this hospital institutional committee in the San Fernando Valley. And several of my friends were really instrumental in organizing it. But I really didn't want to be a part of it. But I said I would go on panels occasionally. Now, there are a lot of rules. Those of you who are in H&I know that they have rules about, you know, you need to go to orientation, you need to do all this kind of stuff to be a panel leader. But, you know, if you've never been to orientation, you don't know that. And my friend was going on vacation and asked me to take over her panel. And I said, sure, I know how to do that. So the panel leader shows up the same night I'm at the hospital. And he said, you know, you can't lead a panel unless you go to orientation. It's next Thursday. Be there. And I want you to know almost all my service work has happened that way. It just got in a 2x4. Clunk, you know. And, you know, that's how I became heavily involved in the Hospital and Institutional Committee of San Fernando Valley. And I took panels into all kinds of places. You know, in the beginning, I did panels in what I call high-bottom facilities, like that care unit where people still had jobs and insurance and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and then I did panels at the VA for a while. That was really fun. It was kind of like being back in the military again. I went to the H&I chairman and I said, I'd like this panel at the VA. And he said, you have to be a veteran to take a panel into the VA. And I said, okay, do I need to bring in my DD-214 or can you just believe me? And, you know, so I took panels there until the earthquake and they closed that facility down. You know, and then I got involved with taking panels into prisons. Now, the scariest place I've ever gone is to the women's prison in Ventura County. It just scared me no end because the place where the guards are was a little room, and all the inmates and us were out in the rest of the thing. But, you know, and I found it scarier that I also took panels for years up to the foreyard at Tehachapi. It's the men's maximum security facility. You know, and when I went there, they have like a facility person that goes with you to the yard, and, you know, we go, and it's a, if you've never been there, the middle of it's like a big two-story open facility, and it's the dining area, and it has like McDonald's tables on it, you know, the old round kind with the chairs all attached, and then up here there are walls, the second story, that wall is all plexiglass, there are little round holes in it, and there are guards with 9mm guns sticking through it, and what the prison official said to me is, now, Marie, if anything happens, just stand still. The guards are very good shots. But I want you to know I learned something really, really important at the foreyard in Tehachapi with those really big, scary people who were never getting back out again. And that was that happy, joyous, and free is an inside job. It doesn't have to do with the kind of house you live in, the kind of car you drive, the kind of clothes you wear, married, single, none of that stuff matters. Being okay is an inside job. Being happy, joyous, and free is something that you just get from inside, and all those things outside don't really count when it comes to being okay on the inside. You know, and I don't know why I couldn't learn that on the outside in Alcoholics Anonymous, why I had to go there to learn it, but that's where I learned that really important message. And then finally, the very last set of institutions they ever managed to get me through the door of were the psych wards. Now, I've never been to a psych ward before I took a panel to one. I had some trouble with that step two, you know, about being restored to sanity because I had never been, like, in a straitjacket. I'd never been institutionalized. I didn't get some of those insanities, that insanity of the first drink, that insanity of thinking next time it was going to be different, the insanity of thinking it's okay to put little kids in a car with a can of beer between your legs and drive a couple hundred miles. You know, I missed all of those things in the beginning. But I really, the psych words were always not my favorite. But I want you to know that I've always been willing to suit up and show up for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think it's one of the reasons that I got to be sober. I did actually get a sponsor finally, so I was about 18 months sober. It was a convention, the Southern California Convention. It was in Bakersfield, and this guy from my meeting that I had been doing service work with, we were sitting there on a Sunday morning, and I said to him, "So will you be my sponsor?" And he said to me, "Men sponsor men, women sponsor women." So I just told everybody he was my sponsor and went on with my life and worked steps with him. I want you to know I was like 17 or 18 years sober before he ever admitted to being my sponsor. And I only have 10 minutes. I better really get moving. So today I actually asked Sylvia to be my sponsor here a couple months ago. It's the first time I've actually ever had a woman sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that it's a good thing. But, you know, I wasn't fond of the women AA when I got here. You know, I didn't trust women. I didn't like women. And plus, I thought like a guy. After all, I'd been in the Navy. I'd been a phone installer. I'd been in the American League. I'd done this. I'd done that. You know, I just really thought I was one of the guys. I was unfortunately to be like 16 years in Alcoholics Anonymous before I figured out that if I really wanted to save my ass and change my life, that I needed to get to know and deal with women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And luckily, I found a really good women's stag meeting at about that time that allowed me to do that. Because before that, if you were a girl in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd be lucky if I knew your name. But when I was new, I knew the name of every guy in that room. You know, and I'm not proud of that. It just is what it is, you know. I mean, it was the way it was for me. And I certainly don't recommend that to anybody because what happened is it's kind of like stunted my own growth, you know. Because the truth is, I found out in my old age, is that I may be able to climb telephone poles, maybe not anymore today, but anyway, I could. And I could crawl into your house, and I knew how to use all kinds of test equipment, and, you know, and I still work in a technical field. But the truth is my insides belong to a girl. You know, I think and act and react most of the time like a woman. And so, you know, I really needed to learn to deal with the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, a lot of things have happened to me and for me over the years. And like I said, in retrospect, what I've learned is that God has always had a better plan for Marie than Marie's had for Marie. And some of my really great examples of that. So I divorced this husband. It was kind of an eighth, ninth step thing. You know, I wasn't in love with him, and I figured if he was ever going to have any kind of happiness or find someone who really cared for him, I just needed to let him go. And, you know, when I did that, I did it with grace, and I did it without dragging him through the coals, and I let him have the house, and I let him have joint, physical, full-time custody, half of the children. And, you know, we still get along to this day, much better than when we were married. And our children are way grown. We have grandkids. So I'm on my own, and, you know, and I'm working, and there's this job I really think is just what I need. And I want this job, and I apply for it, and I get won out by some guy, and I apply for it, and I finally apply for it. I get the job, and then they cancel the job rec, and I'm devastated. But because that happened, I got offered a completely different job in my company that put me on a completely different career path that brought me to where I am today. And all of those guys who got that job were all laid off within 2 years. So, you know, now I know, unfortunately, just from, because God has hit me over the head with 2x4 enough times, that, you know, if I just get out of the way and let God do things, that they'll work out for me. You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous also says, after the promises, that great events will come to pass for you and countless others. So I'd like to share what I consider is my great event. So like I said, in 1966, I had this baby. I put her up for adoption in a closed adoption state, closed the door, and walked away from it. Get married, have a couple little kids. I'm not about to tell them I got another child. I got two little girls. What do you say to them, you know? Oh, your mother's got another baby. She didn't know who knew her father. Who knows who the father is, but there's this other kid hanging out there. You know, but when they were about like 25 or 26, an event occurred in our house that caused me to share that information with them finally. And my youngest daughter was just ecstatic to think that we had more relatives. And so she decided she would get on the Internet and see if she could find this child. Now, they have a lot of, like, free sites on the Internet. I want you to know it took less than 30 days. My daughter and the daughter I put up for adoption, sister, were on the same website in the same 30-day window. She was looking for me, and I was looking for her. And you can call that what you want, but, you know, I have to call that God. And so then I had some really scary events happen because, one, this child wanted to know who I was, why she was put up for adoption, blah, 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 you know, 50,000 questions, you know, and I needed to tell her those answers. And in order to do that, I got on an airplane and flew to Atlanta, Georgia to meet her. I want you to know what's the scariest thing I've done in sobriety. You know, but I went back and, you know, for me, it worked out really well. You know, I told her the truth. I told her that I was an alcoholic in recovery. I told her I was really sorry. I didn't have a clue who her father was. And, you know, and we became part of each other's lives. Now, I'm not her mother. She has a mother. She has a woman who raised her. She has a father. But she and I have a working relationship today. And, you know, she's met the rest of my family. You know, she met my father had already passed, but, you know, she got to meet my mother before she died and, you know, all her other relatives. And when she got married last year, we all flew back from here back to Pensacola for the wedding. And, you know, it's worked out really, really well for me. And I didn't think that I would ever see this child again. You know, that was my thought. And I know it doesn't always work out that well for everybody, but, you know, for me, it worked out really well. You know, so I've had some real joys in recovery, and I've had some sad times. Like I said, I buried both of my parents sober. I'm the only drunk in my family, but I was the only person sober at the funerals. And I was actually grateful for that. You know, I often thought that would be difficult. And yet I tell you, it's much easier to deal with those really hard times in your life when you have a clear mind. You know, and I've had great events. You know, my children got married. When I'm in that care unit in 1980 and my babies are 1 and 2, I'm worried about how are they going to get married if I can't drink. You know? I have a little projection problem. Speaking of projection, I'm not going to get in trouble with my last before this. I do a lot of service work, and when I came to San Diego, I quit doing all that kind of stuff. This year, I'm chairing the turkey-thon. So there are flyers on the table. You all come and eat. All right, I didn't want to get in trouble. I didn't want to leave that out. I'd get hit up by a lot of people. Anyway, come to the turkey-thon. Come for a meeting, come for dinner, just come. Anyway, because I did a lot of service work. When I came to San Diego, I geographicked here. You know, it was really easy to just hide in a corner, you know, to not get a new sponsor, just go to 1 or 2 meetings, not become a part of, you know, and after about a year or so of that, I figured it was a pretty stupid way to stay sober, you know, so I'm really working at trying to get back into the routine that I built for, you know, 28, 29 years in San Fernando Valley. I want you to know that all of my children have been married really well without me getting drunk, without me having to drink, with me being able to toast with apple cider, you know, who knows? You know, nobody cares what you're drinking. You know, they only care what they're drinking. And so, you know, those great events have come for me also. I've got, 2 minutes to tell you all the great things I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. So let me tell you what I know today is I don't know nothing. You know, when I got here, I knew everything except how not to put a drink in my mouth. Today I know how not to put a drink in my mouth, but I don't know a lot about anything else. You know, I try to always keep an open mind. I suffer, however, from that big mouth thing. You know, I wish that it wasn't one of my defects of character, but I tell you, I have to really watch it still. I'm really good at telling you exactly what it is I think, whether it's right or wrong. You know, or whether it's any of my business, that's the worst part. I'm willing to tell you you're wrong when it's none of my business, which is something I'm really working on. You know, so some of my defects are not as bad as they used to be. You know, I learned when I got here there was only one way to do anything, and it was the Marie Buchanan, Marie B way. It was the only way to do anything. You know, it was my way or the highway. You know, and one day in Alcoholics Anonymous, I discovered that you might have an idea that was worth listening to. And then I discovered that you might have an idea that was actually better than mine. And then the great thing came when I actually let you execute that idea that was better than mine, you know? That's some of the kind of growth that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, today I get along with all my children. They don't remember what it was like when I drank because they were too little. I have two beautiful little grandsons who don't have a clue, except that my six-year-old asked me the other day, "Grandma, why does your license tag say 1 day at a time?" And I said to him, "It's because I can only live 1 day at a time," you know, because I figured he's too young to explain to anything else to. But the greatest thing that I've learned in all the time I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous is just one very simple thing, and that's that God could and would if he were sought. Thank you. All right.